Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, home of the modern whitetail hunter. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. I'm your guest host, Tony Peterson, and today I'm joined by Brody Swisher to discuss strategies and tactics for hunting pressured deer during the entire rut. All right, folks, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, which is brought to you by First Light. You might notice that this is not the voice of Mark Kenyon. He's off at the National Air Guitar Championship, where he's competing as a semifinalist after winning the Midwest Regional back in April. So wish him luck. You got me instead. And today, my guest is Brody Swisher. Brody is an outdoor writer and a whitetail nut. He lives in Tennessee, but he hunts all over the country, not only for his job, but for his personal obsession. He's one of my favorite industry personalities for a couple of reasons. He's just down to earth, and he's truly honest about his hunting motivations. I love that, and you're going to hear that in this episode. He's also just ate up with hunting because he loves it, and he'll shoot a deer for meat just as quickly as he'll drop the hammer on a big buck, which is something you know I love too. I had a great time chatting with him, and I think you're going to love his fresh take on hunting and his in-depth strategies for staying on bucks from the last part of October all the way through November. Brody Swisher, it is good to see your face, buddy.
Absolutely, man. Always good to see you and catch up every few months, every season, whatever it is, man. Always good to get back in the groove and catch up with you a bit.
So we were just chatting off air. You and I have hunted together a few times. We've known each other, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years now. And when we were going to set up this interview, I looked back on our text strings to see if I could find your Skype username so I could look you up. And I had totally forgotten about this. You know, but we hunted Florida together on that frickin' mosquito fest down there a few years ago. And there's a part of that text string where I had grunted in a spike and I was texting the guy who was kind of in charge of the thing. I'm like, I got a buck coming. I need to shoot it. I got to shoot it. And he's like, how big is it? I'm like, it's a spike. He's like, you can't shoot it. So I was texting you at the same time. And you're like, brother, you got to shoot that deer. And I'm like, they won't let me.
Yep. Well, I remember that hunt well. And I think about it every season, honestly. It's just, you know, good or bad on the outcome of the hunt. It's always good memories, you know, some stories in there. But I just remember, same deal. I think it was my last hunt of the you know, the trip and you know, just like I said, the spike comes out and like, they know, man, it's gotta be 4 inches, 5 inches, whatever they gotta be for spike. And I'm ready to, you know, unload, turn it loose, send it. And they slapped you on the hand, said, no, you can't do that. And same deal on the first day. I remember the first day I had all these does kept coming by me. I'm like, hey, we good to shoot does. I'm fixing to send it on one of these suckers. And oh no, you can't shoot does. And I was like, dude, I wouldn't have come to Florida if I'd have known ahead of time that I can't shoot does or, you know, any of the mixed bag and meat critters. So, yeah, that was a fun hunt, tough hunt, but, good times nonetheless.
It was, and it, you know, it, what it makes me think about that, I think, you know, I don't want to get in trouble with this, but I'm going to say it anyway. So that was a media hunt, right? This camo company brought us down there to do that hunt, test out some stuff. So that was bought and paid for. We didn't pay for it. It was kind of a guided deal. And the assumption on those hunts is always that it's a trophy hunt. Like you just, you show up and everybody's hunting trophies and it's just like accepted that way. And so when somebody like you or I gets into the camp, it sort of shakes things off the foundation just a little bit because you know, you do the same thing I do in those situations. I don't really do those hunts anymore, but I always would be like, what's the smallest thing I can shoot and not get kicked out of camp? And, you know, that's one of the reasons I think that you and I have gotten to be good buddies is that I would label you as just a hunter. Like I wouldn't say straight public land hunter, private land hunter, deer grower, trophy hunter, none of that. I would just be like, that dude is just a hunter of critters. And I love that.
Yep. Absolutely. That's me, man. I'm in the same boat as a lot of guys. We all want to see the big bucks, man. Who doesn't want to shoot a big buck? For somebody to say, I'm not a big buck hunter and I'll pass on a trophy when he comes back because I want to shoot it. We're not doing that. But, man, here's the deal. I mean, I like to hunt. I like to provide. I like to take care of my family. I like the experiences. I like the story. I like to prove once again to myself and remind myself that I can do it again and still got it, whatever. All the different aspects for me go into it. It doesn't matter. Public land, private land, whatever. I enjoy the hunt. And as long as it's legal and you're doing things like you're supposed to, I love to play the game every time. And so it is. Just I'm very much an opportunistic hunter. And like I said, trophy buck, spike buck. I love to tell a story, make stories. And so it's hard not to take advantage of those opportunities when they come. And I still love it. You know, I've been doing it a long time, but I still love coming to full draw, seeing if I can get to full draw with one standing right there at 12 yards. And so it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And you've got a big family and you feed them a lot of wild game. And I had a conversation the other day with a fellow that I kind of like, I know him a little bit. And he's a bow hunter, and he was telling me how him and his son 3 years ago both shot nice bucks, and they're still eating them. And I was just like, you guys haven't gone through, you know, I mean, even if they're really big bucks, what are you talking, 100, 110 pounds of meat, maybe, you know, and this is kind of northern Minnesota, so they're going to be big deer. But I was like, how the hell could you not go through that meat in, you know?
Yeah. That's it. I don't know. They must not be eating enough tacos or something, but it gets going quick. And I do, I laugh every time I see, you know, it seems like it's some chick or whoever, you know, social media, and they'll kill a 60 pound doe and like just filled the freezer. And I'm like, no, you did not. You know, I don't know how big your freezer is, but you know, it's going to take more than that. I love you the trying, but yeah, it takes us a lot of meat to fill the freezer, and we do keep it stocked. And that's usually, you know, about this time of year, my wife's like, hey, you need to get out there and kill some critters, because we're getting thin in the freezer. And so I love those directions and orders from the boss to get out there and get some meat. So,
yeah, that part's fun. I mean, when you think about that, you know, I always use this as an example. This was probably 12, 13 years ago. This was back when a non-resident could buy an over-the-counter antelope tag in North Dakota for archery. And I went out, a couple of buddies of mine and my dad, we went out hunting for the opener, and I shot an antelope the first night. And, you know, it wasn't a real big goat or anything. Even a big one is not that big, but we ate that entire thing during our hunt, except for one. I had one sandwich bag, maybe it was tenderloins or something, of meat that I brought home from that. It was like, it was awesome. You know, every night you're feeding four guys who are spotting and stalking all day, you know.
That's so right.
We ate a lot. And so it was like every night was awesome, 'cause you're eating fresh antelope. But then when you go home from a hunt where you were successful and you've got like 7 ounces of meat, it kind of sucks.
You bring home a Ziploc bag to the rest of the family. Not quite as impressed, are they?
No, but that part's good. You started out your fall this year, way back in, you know, early September, maybe even late August, hunting some velvet deer, and you killed one in Kentucky, right?
That's right. Yeah, that was the start to my season. First, I got to play the game there, and man, had a great week. It was fun. I was kind of getting over the COVID stuff from a month ago or better, and just kind of getting my energy back, and it was a great way to get in the stand and just be back in the woods bow hunting again. Man, I look forward to it every year. Like I said, this year was a little bit of a struggle, just not having the energy. That COVID kind of sucked the life out of me, but just getting back in the game, a lot of fun. Yeah, we had a great time hunting, not too far from me. I'm on the Tennessee line with Kentucky, so you know, 30-minute trip up the road, and it's always good to, you know, start the season off there, and it's a hunt where, you know, depending on where you are, what your setup is, it's everything wrong with the world according to social media. Hunting private farms, you can hunt over corn up there, you can do all the stuff, and but I tell guys, I say, man, it's just a fun hunt to catch up with friends, be back in camp. Again, if it's legal, I enjoy it. You know, and I love tapping into that opportunity, you know, hunting afternoons there. And yeah, I guess it was the second night of the hunt. Sitting up on a little ridge that had food plots on top and had corn out as well. And just a beautiful evening. I had several bucks come through, had some does and fawns, and the buck that I was after was just a goofy 7-pointer buck that my buddy said, hey man, I've got this 7-pointer. He's an older buck, very mature buck, but he just never has grown. He got short tines, kind of the short tines 7-pointer, one side's goofy. And And again, just being an opportunistic hunter, I said, man, let's put me in the stand, man. Let me turn me loose. I'll go after it, you know. So I've enjoyed those opportunities sometimes, call it a coal man or whatever, you know, just shooting the deer that other guys won't. And man, it's, again, I have a big time. I got a story to tell, memories made. And, you know, some guys will go home empty handed because they don't want to shoot a certain deer. They got a higher standard. And that's okay too, you know. Yep. But I just love to play the game, you know, coming home with a cooler full of meat and stories made. And so can't complain one bit.
Yeah. And those, I was talking to Tyler Jones from The Element after he went down, he went up to Nebraska and he killed a nice buck right away. First couple days of the season, and just talking to him, and he was like, as I was talking to him, he was cutting that deer up and he was just happy. Like, just, yeah. You know, you start the season, you know, and we're in a little bit different a place because we make our living off of this. So when you get that monkey off your back right away, it's nice, but it's absolutely just so fun to start the year right away with a successful hunt like that. It's such a freaking blast, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the deal for me. The next night or two after that buck, I shot a doe. And so had two deer in the cooler, and it is, man. The monkey's off the back, get to come home, and knowing that, hey, our regular season here in Tennessee hadn't even started. We've got a couple more weeks, but I've already got two tags punched, you know, for the season, testing out some gear and just two deer in, you know, right off the bat. So my kids are fired up because they know, hey, that means opening day is their time. They're thinking, Dad's done for a while. We're up to bat, you know, in the stand or ground blind.
So you mentioned, I want to talk about pre-rut and rut strategies with you,
yeah.
But you mentioned taking your kids. How many kids you got hunting now?
Well, I've got four kids, and my oldest daughter, she's 18, and she's big into soccer, and her hunting, you know, she'll hunt a time or two a year now, you know, she's just so busy with everything. But my boys, I got three boys that any given weekend think they need to be in the woods. It's their turn. And so they all love it. And so, yeah, it's fun. It's a challenge just because, again, they all want to go. And so just making those opportunities, getting those blinds in the right spot and just setting up for success is tough. But and there's many times where I'm in the blind with them and we're two or three of us in the blind, and I swear I'll never do it again. And then I get home and I realize, man, that's the memories that we're making for a lifetime, you know?
Yeah. So do you, when you're bringing those boys, are you hunting as well, or are you just guiding?
No, I'm just guiding. I used to do that. I used to pack my bow in there and think, okay, well, maybe you'll shoot one and I will. And then it just turns into cluster. And then of course in their mind too, they're thinking, well, this ain't about me. This is about him. You know, he's going to shove me out of the way if the big buck walks out. That's why he's got his bow. And so, yeah, anymore, I carry the camera and it's just all about them getting the shot and, you know, depending on the situation. I mean, if there is a legitimate, for my older boy, if there's a legitimate opportunity for us to, you know, double up on turkeys or, you know, if there's an opportunity for a double, true double opportunity, then maybe, you know, but, for the most part, it's just, it's back in their gear and we got so much crap to carry. I don't, the thought of carrying my own stuff, you know, for me as well, it's not a chance, you know. We got so much stuff, cameras and gear and tripods and ground blinds and all the stuff. And so there's more than enough boat as it is.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. You know, when I take my little girls out, because we're hunting, whether it's turkeys or deer, we're hunting out of blinds. And I kind of made the decision when I started with them. I'm like, it's their time. I'm just going to guide.
Yeah.
And I don't bring a weapon. And I actually love it. Like it really causes me to just be, like you said, you know, like this is for them. And so my decision-making process is always like, how do we get them a bird or how do we get them a deer? And I don't know about you, but I actually feel like, even though, like you said, you got a ton of gear to carry and you got a lot of stuff to think about with kids, I feel so unburdened because I'm not worried about filling a tag for myself. I feel that's like right. I just flow state that stuff so much better. And I'm just like, I'm in it. It makes me feel like I'm in it for the right reasons. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's so pure. And, again, to me, it's just in making those memories, you know, and I think back to my first opportunities and man, I remember those so much and just appreciate my dad so much for not blowing it and leaving me behind and making sure he invested in me and taking me on those opportunities that I've never forgotten, you know, some of the greatest memories of my life. And so I just think, man, this is an investment. It's an investment in your time, your love, your energy. And man, don't miss out on that, because it's going to come back and it's going to be way bigger than me going off and shooting any buck of any kind on my own, you know, is investing in those memories.
Yeah. Can I go on a rant for a second? Because what you just said reminds me of something that pisses me off. And I'm curious if you ever experienced this. So, you know, you have the one daughter and then you got three boys. I have two daughters. And it's weird because, you know, my daughters are, they're bumping up on 10 years old. And it's weird how often people tell me how horrible they're going to be. And like even strangers, you know, they'll send me an email and be like, you know, it's really awesome that you're taking your girls hunting, but in 4 years, you're going to hate them and you're going to want to do this and they're going to hate you. And I'm like, I know that that's a possibility. Believe me. Like I get it. And like, B, like, where do we get if you constantly remind me of this? You know what I mean? Like what are we doing here? It, like, I don't want to sit there and look at the future and be like, well, this could suck, so I'm going to let it ruin this time now. It's bizarre to me.
Yeah. Well, and I hear that from time to time too. And you know, I'm usually quick to say, hey, you know, just because you had a bad experience with your family and your situation or whatever, doesn't mean that's going to be my deal with my daughter, you know, whatever. And she still loves it. I mean, she's so busy with everything else, but, yeah, it is. You just have to make it happen, you know, in this moment, not focus on what's going to be on down the line and what might change or whatever. And again, just invest in the time you've got right now. And, you know, like I said, even despite the fact that she's gotten busier and doesn't get to hunt as much, I mean, every year she'll still say, hey, I want to go, you know, I want to get out there with you. And I think for her more than anything, I think it's just about being with me, you know, spending the time. She enjoys that. And so, yeah, I just keep taking them and don't push it. Don't force, you know, just let them do their thing and enjoy it. And again, just being together, making those memories, and it's hard to beat.
Yeah, it's awesome. So we're bumping right up on here, pre-rut, coming into the rut. What are your plans for late October throughout November?
Gosh, man, you know, I just think all the time, more and more, I find myself digging the last week of October. And, you know, that time, last week of October through those first couple weeks of November before bucks just absolutely lose their mind, some of the best time. I think, you know, guys miss out a lot of times taking, putting in all their time and taking their vacation for the rut itself, you know, miss out a lot of opportunities at pre-rut, you know, starting late October. I mean, man, gosh, late October could be the best possible time. You know, I've killed a lot of good bucks, you know, that pre-rut. And that's, to me, is when things start shaking, things start kicking, is that late October and that first week of November. For me, that's when I do the majority of my calling, the most responsive, I see and calling, be it rattling, grunting, and calling bucks out of those bedding areas, those thickets that I'm hanging out near. But it just really starts to happen in that time again. A lot of guys will take their time later on in November, but, and that's good because that opens the woods up for me. But, you know, that time, last week of October, first part of November, again, calling is key. I do a lot of that. But to me, it's that time when those bucks first start realizing, here we go. You know, the big boys start realizing, you know, and they start slipping a little further and further. I know some guys will say bucks are, you know, completely nocturnal or whatever, but man, in my mind, there's a buck standing on his feet somewhere. You just got to get close enough to where you're going to see him. You know, he's going to get up, he's going to move around. Yeah, he may be nocturnal from the standpoint of running wide open through the fields in the day or big timber, but man, he's on his feet somewhere. He's going to get up and stretch somewhere. And as that October, end of October comes on, first part of November, that's when, again, I see them starting venturing further and further from that bed. And they start cracking out in that food plot, you know, before last light, or they start getting out where your tree stand is, wherever it is, you know, placement wise, they're just starting to venture a little further and further from their beds. And that's that first opportunity for those bigger deer to get out and see what all the fuss is about. Because, you know, good and well, all those young bucks, man, they're running wide open thinking, you know, it's go time, starting mid-October, whatever. And, you know, the guys get fired up, say, hey, man, the rut's on. Well, you just got them young bucks, those older bucks, you know, they're kind of hanging back. They've played the game. They know the deal. They'll kind of lay low. But again, you get into that last week of October, first part of November. And again, just catching them starting to slip up on their feet a little more, get out and venture around a little more. You know, just a good time to be in the tree.
Are you, when you're talking about this late October type of hunting where you're calling and you're, you know, hopefully close to a bedding area, are you, cause when you talk about that, I think about my strategy and I really go, if you were to take like, I don't know, October 25th, I'm probably going to be a staging area. You know, by Halloween or November 1st, then I'm really starting to think those pinch points and, you know, like the terrain, really using the terrain to my advantage. But when you talk about late October whitetails, it sounds like you're talking about kind of got those bucks pinned down. You're like, all right, he's probably going to be bedding here. I know he's going to that plotter. He's going to that field. You're going to creep in there to that cover pretty close and just use that, his kind of, willingness to just get up a little earlier in daylight, move around, make some rubs. But it sounds like you're talking about an in the cover strategy mostly.
Yeah, very much so. It is that staging area. And I saw it real well. I was able to show it to my son several, several years ago. You know, we'd sit in the field and watch the field and, you know, night after night, he's like, we didn't see anything. You know, we didn't see anything. Nothing happened in the field. There's just no deer moving. And, we came out on a trail that we had found in a field and, entry trail to the field. And look, let's back down this trail. They're always coming out last light, dark, whatever. We always find them there. We found that trail. We just backtracked down about 75 yards, 100 yards into the woods and just down a little, just a little knife ridge and just very narrow trail right up the sides of it though. And we set up in there and it was just night and day difference catching those deer again, late October. And they were just all hanging out right there. And I'm like, dude, we missed it. We're sitting out in the field waiting on something to happen in the field, but it's all right here. We would have never known. We back at a stand up in there and get him up in there, and he was able to kill a little 10-pointer, and it just came right down the trail right in front of him. And just a beautiful thing, man. And again, it's just backing up, catching those staging areas, finding those deer that have slid out of their bedding areas, and they're not blowing out in that field yet, corn, beans, whatever it is. They're not blowing out there yet. They're still hanging back. The safety, the security of that little staging area.
Yeah, when you talk about that, you bring up a really, really interesting point there about just a reset moment of going back 75 yards. This is a mistake a lot of people make. And I think we've had some mixed messaging in the public land, do-it-yourself type of world where there's a lot of people pushing this bedding message, and there's people who are super good at hunting beds. But I think for the average person, it's probably better to be like really incremental in your strategy. So if you, like you said, if you get on that field edge and you really want to hunt there and they aren't showing, the assumption is I got to go right in on top of his bed or they're nocturnal, both of which are probably not true or they're not inherently true. And when you're bow hunting, even private land, public land, it doesn't really seem to matter. Those deer that you're talking about there and taking your son in there and killing them, those deer are just waiting for you guys to leave. There's a reason they're staging in there. They know where that hunting pressure is concentrated, and they know it as little as 75 yards away. They're safe to get up and eat some acorns or do whatever they want, make a rub, check a scrape. They're just not going out where you've been concentrating your pressure. And as little of a move as that is can make all the difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. Excuse me. And I think we do between checking stuff, scouting stuff, and you know, we got to be scouting. I get it, but I think so many guys underestimate the fact that every scouting trip they make, every trail camera check they make, every time they're setting foot in there and trimming shooting lanes, going back and double checking everything's good, and just wanting to look one more time, and all the stuff of that human pressure in there, and they just underestimate the fact that those deer know, man. You know, you may get by with the young bucks, young does, and stuff may not give a rip, but those mature deer know, bucks, does, whatever. They know, dude. They know you the first time you step in those woods, I believe. You know, that's why you got to make it happen. That first scent trail you lay down. And yes, they just immediately, I think, one of the places we've seen, you know, just know right away, hey, we're going to slide out a little further down the field. They're going to make, you know, instead of coming out where they always did, all of a sudden you notice they came out, you know, 100 yards further down the field. You know, coincidence? I don't think so. I think those dudes know they're playing you just as much as you're playing them.
Yeah. Well, they are. And they're, you know, I think about, you know, I hunt like northern Wisconsin quite a bit around end of October, beginning of November. And so there's, you know, a lot of years where you're dealing with snow, right? Like you might get a couple inches of fresh snow. And the one thing that always just amazes me is, you know, if I throw up a stand on private land and leave it up overnight and we get snow, it's almost a guarantee that I'll see deer tracks walking up to that sucker and somewhere throughout the night. And it's the same thing when you put up a trail camera, you know, the first series of pictures you get are almost always deer looking at it. And a lot of times you get that old doe sniffing right on it or the buck. I mean, and it's, you think, oh, they smelled it. Maybe they smelled it. Maybe they saw it. It doesn't matter. They knew you were there and that's they, right. And they checked it out. And you think about, you know, that the strategy that's so common is to hunt early, sit on your field edges, and then kind of take a break during the lull or whatever, and then swing back around this time of year and start getting onto those field edges again, waiting for those does to draw the bucks out. But all of that pressure in the same spot, it just puts them off. And, you know, when you, like you said something earlier about nocturnal bucks and, you know, like, well, maybe they're nocturnal, maybe they're not, or something to that effect. I literally don't believe there's a nocturnal deer out there. Like you know, and you've seen this, I'm sure. When you go hunt like Western whitetails, I mean, you can do this with mule deer too, even though they're different, but you go watch Western whitetails bed down somewhere out in the sage or something. And if you hang with them, those deer get up, they reposition with the sun, with the wind, they browse for a while, or, you know, you get into a situation like I killed a buck a couple years ago in Nebraska on public land on opening night or the second night. I can't remember. First 2 days of the season. And they were bedding in the middle of a bean field on this walk-in land. They'd get up, feed for a while, bed down, get up all day long. And, you know, I mean, those are deer on public land. There's people messing around there. And they're still not, they're not nocturnal the way we think. They're just not, like you said, they're not coming out into that field blowing across it at noon because they're out of their minds with the buzz and their nuts.
That's right. That's exactly it. You know, the nocturnal thing, again, they're moving somewhere. You know, we have this idea that they're not moving unless they're night. Well, they're not moving where you're at. You know, they're not moving in those easy stands you've got hung out there, just, you know, right next to your truck or whatever. But if you dig a little deeper, you go a little further in. And like you said earlier, just talking about the increments, don't just bust it in there and go, hey, we've got to get in the middle of the bedding area right now because they're not coming in the field anymore. But just keep checking away, you know, and just little increments, take it in 75 yards closer, 100 yards, and just see what you got. Maybe they don't hit that night. You need to realize, hey, I've got to take it on in another little bit. Just keep working your way in, letting that activity dictate kind of how far you go. But it, like you said, he's moving somewhere. He's going to stand up. He's going to get out of that sun. He's going to move over it maybe 10 yards, maybe 50 yards. He's going to move and reposition himself with the wind, get out of the sun, find the shade. Browse a little bit, whatever. And, so he's moving somewhere. It's just a matter of you being in that spot, being close to that spot where you can see that activity when he does stand up.
Yeah. And I think when, to go back to what you talked about, where your son killed that buck and just moving 75 yards off, when you think about, you think about how important confidence is to so much stuff. Like I talk about this a lot, but I train bird dogs and I work with professional dog trainers all the time. And the good ones, they're just helping dogs constantly develop confidence, new situations, new people, whatever. And you think about whitetail hunting, and the one thing that we do a lot, or you see a lot of, you know, a lot of new hunters do, is they give into that gotta be where you can see mentality. Rifle hunters do this like crazy. I mean, it's one of the reasons why the rifle hunting or the general gun hunting success is so low, I think, or it could be higher, is because we just have to be where we can see. And so you think about, if you've got that field edge, one of the best strategies people could take is if your action dies, you just go get off of that sucker 30, 40, 50 yards and start looking. Go in, you know, like you said, follow that trail in, follow it back. But the problem we have is we are like, well, I'm going to set up so I can shoot that edge, or I'm going to set up so I'm close enough and do both. And oftentimes you just have to go, I'm not going to be on this edge today. I'm not sitting over this field. I'm just going to move in a little bit and I'm going to be looking the opposite way. I'm going to look back into the cover and I'm going to see what those deer are doing. And you see them, when you see them staging, it's just obvious. You know, you see him work through one way, or you work through another way, or, you know, he's making a rub here and all of a sudden you see the buck come up from the other side and they meet up for a while and you just look at it and go, that's just where they're comfortable mingling there in daylight.
That's right.
Those spots are money.
Yeah. And it's so fun to be in those spots too, because like you said, they're comfortable there. They know they're good there in their mind. they're good there. They're not walking out like we see them so many times, skittish, nervous, on edge. They know they're in a spot that they're good to go. They've been doing it on a routine at the staging area where it's a sanctuary in their mind. They feel comfortable and they just kind of, like you said, congregate there, chill, waiting on that sun to crawl down. And it's a lot of fun to discover those spots. When you find that spot, you know you've got something, and that's a spot where stuff's going to happen. And that's where my phone hunting app is full of those kind of spots that I just look forward to every year when the wind gets right and everything's lining up to get into those spots. And that's when you're on the edge of your stand, whatever it is, because it's getting ready to happen.
Yeah. And you get, you know, we talk about this all the time, you know, the first sit's the best in a stand, or, you know, that's the mobile hunting strategy is so popular partially for this reason. But really, one of the benefits we don't talk about of getting into a spot like that, when you talk about where deer are comfortable, they're easier to hunt. Like they're just not, you know, you talk about that little knife ridge you're talking about where that feeds up to that food source. They're traveling a certain way. They're using the wind and they're looking and they're not expecting danger there the way they are when they pop into that food plot. Or, you know, over in Wisconsin where we hunt, baiting is legal. And if you just put a trail camera up, you don't have to have any corn in front of it, or you put a new ladder stand up. I think those deer are so used to walking into, like, oh, there's another corn pile here, there's a camera there, there's a ladder stand 20 yards away. And if you tip them off, like I do really well over there showing up and hanging stands in places that they're not associating anything with humans. And I just think they get to it. There's like a certain set of, you know, factors in a spot that they just go, uh-oh, I've seen that before. I've seen this before. Every time I come into this, there's bad smells here. And they're just more on edge, like just like that little kill plot you sit over and over and over again. Like, it can be a producer all season long, but like you're also just tipping your hat to them. Like they know, like, okay, this is a more dangerous place than that spot I like back on that knob over on the hill that nobody seems to come into.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people don't realize that those deer, about the time we feel like we've got them patterned, you know, those deer have got us patterned. You know, they pattern us and get us on a routine just as easy. So like you said, it's so important to not let them get you in a routine and not always slip in from the same way, not always follow the same trails in, same trails out, you know, and just try different things. You know, don't keep playing the same game each time and just let those deer, you know, pattern you, get in that spot where they never see it coming. That's a fun spot to be for sure.
It is. So when you're talking late October, maybe early November, and you're talking about calling, what are you going with here? Rattling? What are you doing?
Yeah, rattling for me is just because of the volume that you can produce with rattling horns. That's kind of been the thing for me. Rattling with grunting mixed in, and again, I'll just get into some of those areas. Again, late October, early November, you're going to see a lot of those young bucks running. They're just young year and a half old bucks, whatever, and they're just running wide open, chasing every slick head they see. But I like to put those horns together and start that calling just because I want that buck to think, hey, you know what? Maybe there is something going on this time. You know, they hear all the commotion and the bucks chasing, and a lot of times I feel like they're just laying over there just chilling, waiting on time to be right or get the right smell they aren't waiting for. But again, just curiosity. You know, a lot of times that's all it takes to just get that buck on his feet and get him come and check you out, just a curiosity, and get him cruising over your way. And again, I'm not often trying to call him out into a field and, you know, all that stuff. It's just that little bit of action at some of those spots that, again, that you know that they're comfortable hanging out in, or spots that they've proven via trail cameras or whatever to frequent. And just letting them know there's a story going on over here. Everybody loves a good fight. And so that's kind of the thing. You know, I want that big buck to know that not only are these young bucks over here chasing your does, now there's some stuff happening and they're fighting over doe as something is intensified. And again, just paint that picture. And it's, again, you know, people ask, you call them up every time? Heck no, man, there's more times than not you don't. But when it's happening, it's so fun. And it's usually once a year for me when I'll rattle the antlers and put them down. Here comes a buck. And then you let him go off and give him a while and rattle again. And it's just when those bucks are at that peak curiosity moment. And again, nine times out of 10, it's going to be that small guy. But every once in a while, you pick it up and play the game, paint the picture, and a good buck will step out. I saw it several years ago hunting a little public piece on the edge of a swamp, and it was just a piece where everything's cruises through and rattled the antlers, grunted a little bit, and had a can call, tipped the can call over. And, I mean, it was under a minute, and this buck comes cruising up looking. And it was just that thick stuff you're talking about. And just came right up through the edge of that stuff, looking, got to shoot him, and fell over right there in front of me. And so, again, calling's not a strategy that's going to work every time. It's just another tool in your bag of tricks. But it's a time of year, I think, again, late October, early November, when it works the best, you know, I think, in my experience where I hunt.
Are you doing mornings mostly, or are you doing mornings and evenings?
I'll start, yeah, at that time of year, you know, right as we're cracking in on the end of the month, you know, heading into November, I'll start hitting those morning sets for sure, you know, just because I am digging into a little deeper areas that I can get into.
I mean, calling-wise, like rattling-wise?
I'll call either. That 10-pointer I just mentioned that I killed was the morning, you know, the first 45 minutes of daylight, and so just called him right place, right time. So, yeah, I can't say whether one, you know, morning or afternoon has worked better. I've experienced both, and maybe even more so in the mornings. You know, if I look back and see a lot of the times that I've called, it's been those morning sets, you know. So, yeah, I'll hit them on either side, morning or afternoon.
When you're rattling, do you always just start out with a little tickle and then work your way up?
Yeah, and for me, it's very short. You know, a lot of guys get the antlers and they're just busting antlers and just going at it and just getting fired up and going, you know, minute, 2 minutes or whatever. But, you know, you look at, if you've seen bucks fight, I mean, there's not a lot of nonstop. They're not just rattling and rattling and rattling. They're rattling and then they lock up and then it's more, you're stomping the ground. It's leaves getting shoved around. It's more shoving match at that point, just to tickle. And then they rattle together and they bust loose and they'll hit together again and they lock up. And so, yeah, I start off light and then, and I work up to, you know, a substantial fight, but for me, it's really just keeping it short, just a light, you know, tickle the horns, keep it quick, you know, 15, 20 seconds, whatever, and stop and get ready. Cause I mean, if you're in that area where it's happening, man, I've gotten busted so many times, you know, sitting there for 30, 45 seconds, a minute with horns and just rattling and you walk in and get busted. So, just a quick little fight, let them know something's come together, put their heads together and then, hang them up and get ready.
So you try to add in other sound elements into your rattling sequences?
I will. I'll throw some grunts in and you know, just typically I'm in a tree. If I'm on the ground, I'll stomp the ground and different stuff like that. But you know, I know there's a lot of stuff I'll see guys do that'll you know, as far as breaking brush or breaking branches and stuff and all those things, you know, adding, you know, trying to add some realism to it. But for me, it's, you know, just grunting, you know, and hitting those horns together. And then, like I said, when I wrap up, I'll tip a can call over. I know a lot of guys laugh at a can style call, you know, and again, never works every time, but I've had enough hunts that they have come in on a string that I'll use that. Again, just telling that picture, you got a fight over here. You got two bucks going at it. And then having that can call just tells, hey, there's a doe that they're fighting for, you know, and yeah. I just try to paint that picture.
Yeah. I think it's a real eye opener when you see a real buck fight close.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think about it, you know, if you hunt, you know, a lot of people who hunt out east or who hunt public land generally have probably heard their neighbors rattling. Like, and when you hear it, it's like listening to a politician speak. You're just like, this is not, there's bullshit here. Like, this is not, it's not the right soundscape, you know?
Yeah.
And when you see, like, you know, you said everybody loves a good fight. The first one I ever saw, I was in high school and I was on this ridge, this valley below me, and I heard a fight break out below me and I'm glassing and I picked up these two bucks. And at the time they were huge to me. They were probably like 2 year olds, but they were bigger than the spikes and forkies we were usually targeting. And those two bucks started fighting. And because of my vantage point, I saw like 9 deer run in and watch this thing. It was like one of the most amazing experiences I've had in the woods. And it made me realize, cause we had tried rattling and it made me realize like, man, when these deer actually go at it, like you said, it's a real short duration lockup, but it's loud and there's a lot going on. Like, yeah. You know, that was in October. So there was, you know, the leaf litter was out and, you know, breaking branches. It just opens your eyes. Like, yeah, if you're a buck there, like we give them too much credit a lot of times for being smart, I think, but they're cautious. And if they're sitting there listening and they're like, okay, this just, they're probably not thinking, man, this is weird that their antlers are hitting together, but I can't hear their hooves on the ground.
Right.
But there's probably something, just like a turkey when it walks in and your decoy shines wrong. It's not like that's a fake bird. It's just like, I don't feel good about this anymore. I'm going away. You know what I mean? Yep. Like there's probably not like a whole lot of thought to it. And so I think a lot of times people don't sell their calling sessions. I mean, man, I was sitting over a river in North Dakota, probably, I don't know, 3-4 years ago in mid-October. And I had these two bucks come down to cross to me and they met in the river and they started fighting in the river. And I'm telling you, it was like, it sounded like they were storming the beach at Normandy, man. There was rocks just like cracking and splashing. And it was like 50,000 times louder than most of our rattling sessions would ever even consider being, you know? And it was, it was like, oh, here's two 200 pound animals fighting. This is not, you know, like this is not play, right? Like these dudes are trying to kill each other. And the sound to it is just so vastly different than what we probably put into most of our average calling sessions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's certainly a difference in those shoving matches, you know, that those bucks, you know, when they come out of velvet, you know, back earlier on in the month and, you know, or September even, you know, and they strip that velvet and they would go from being buddies to start, you know, just establishing who's the boss. And, you know, they're just kind of shoving matches there. But yeah, like you're talking about that in the river throwdown death match. I mean, that's where there's some serious commotion going on. And so, you know, again, it just comes down to what you're, you know, trying to tell, what the story and what kind of, you know, audible you need to cast as far as your, you know, how far you need to get that sound out there, banging on that again. And, but again, for me, it's making those calling sequences short, putting together that sound and then hang it up, because man, so many times I can tell you so many more times than not, I'll get caught in the past. Anyway, I've gotten busted sitting there standing with the horns in my hand and here he comes walking out looking and they're coming in looking, you know, like you said, serious. So they're on the lookout when they're coming in and they just don't get caught with your grunt call and your hand call and your antlers in your hand and get caught looking, you know. So
yeah, it's definitely something to think about. It's an interesting thing. I mean, I think one of the great intangibles of this when you're talking about calling in the pre-rut and during the rut is when you know, if you go sit, I'll never forget. I sat during rifle season in Minnesota years ago on this property and the neighbor was rattling and it was like once every 10 minutes, that guy would bang the antlers together and create this fake fight. And it would be like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 days into gun season. I'm like, dude, and you know, like when you're talking about that buck that you rattled in and you get close to the swamp and you get in the right spot and then the timing feels right. It's just like, it's a hard thing to talk about because we sell these ideas like, well, go out and rattle in the pre-rut or the first couple of days of November. But the people who really know what they're doing with this stuff, they're sitting there going, this is the right time. Like this, I can just feel it in the air. It's cool. It's 10 minutes into first light and I can see really well. Or, you know, you're on stand in the afternoon and it's getting a little later and then the clouds roll in and the light changes and the wind shifts. And you go, they're going to be on their feet right now. This is what they're callable. And so it's a really fun thing to talk about, but I always just want to caution people, like understand that, you know, you've said this multiple times that this is not like a guarantee and it is not. I mean, it might be like a 10% success rate, maybe depending on where you hunt, but you can up those odds if you call like deer actually sound and you're just reading those conditions going, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, sun's high overhead. I haven't seen a freaking songbird in 3 hours. It's not the time, but 6:30 at night and it's, you know, getting a little darker and that, you know, the temps drop 20 degrees or 15 degrees. Then you're like, okay, now this is the time.
Yep. Absolutely. And I think of another hunt from several years back that, again, talking about the can call, I don't know that I've ever heard. I mean, I've heard deer bleat. I've heard deer grunt, do different things. But I don't know if I've ever heard a can, you know, a deer sound just like a can call, you know, long drawn out deal. That's why some people say it's no good. But I was hunting in the timber several years ago, gun season, sitting up there with my bow. And I had watched it looked like a spiker, a forky, something, just going back and forth chasing this doe. Again, just like, good gosh, man, leave her alone, whatever. He's just going nuts, back and forth, over this little saddle out in front of me, over the ridge, doing their thing. But then one time I look up and I heard crashing again, and I look up and I see some antlers. I put my binos up and I see, and that's not the spiker, and he's by himself. And he had come in looking. He heard the sound of all the commotion. And I took, he was probably 80 to 100 yards out, and I just tipped that can call, pulled out of my pocket, tipped it over. And I look up, and it caught his attention. Here he comes down that ridge I was sitting on. He walked, you know, 25, 30 yards, and he'd stop. And, excuse me, I'd tip the can call over again. He'd get a read on it. Here he'd come another 25 yards. And, man, I just kept it up. He'd, again, walk 20, 25, 30 yards. He'd look up, ears come up, looking and listening. Hit him. I think I did three or four, you know, licks on that can call, and he marched up there and turned broadside. I shot him right there at 18 yards maybe. But he was a classic example of that deer that was hearing the sound of some rutting activity. He heard that chasing, and again, a spike buck chasing a doe around. And he heard that. He came looking for that. He came to investigate. He knew what was up, and then just intercepted him with that can call and pulled him in there and made the shot. Nice buck. And so, again, no call works every time. Don't let somebody tell you they do. But I like to have them in the tool bag because there is a time when they will. And, you know, take their temperature, use those calls, see what you got. Early November, you know, early part of the rut, it's all the time. Oftentimes, it's, excuse me, just what you need to get him in there where you want him with that bow.
Yep. That, what you said there about that buck hearing that little guy chasing around, I read something years and years ago that Scott Bestel wrote in Field and Stream, where he said the best deer call you could probably ever have would be the sound of deer running.
Yeah.
And yep. I mean, again, you know, and that's a strategy people use walking into their stands and stuff. You know, and I firmly believe in it. I believe in the same way. I don't know if you do this or not, but I carry a turkey mouth call with me a lot. Mm. And if I have to walk in and there's leaves and it's calm, I just scratch my way in and I yelp softly. And I've had two awesome things happen there. I've had deer be really close to me and I've called in turkeys when I've done it. And, but just sounding, you know, sounding like the woods is really important. Let's say you strike out on this late October, right away in November pattern, and you're moving to the just chasing phase, crazy November 7th, 8th, things should be busting open. Where are you sitting?
Yeah. So that's kind of the deal for me. November 12th has become my hot days used to be, you know, when I lived in Montana, I had a streak of November 8th being the day, the go-to day for me, and just kill bucks on that day for a number of years. And then when I got back to Tennessee, it became November 12th through 13th, 14th, right in there. And so that's kind of where I've looked and where I, you know, had some good success here in West Tennessee over the recent years. But in those couple of years, I've noticed that, you know, just catching those deer slipping along a couple different transition lines. And, you know, I've got some thick cover that I love to sit in several spots, and it's just that thicket where I know those does are going to hang out, and they're going to be in there, going there to bed, and those bucks will just come up cruising that transition line. He'll be on that downwind side, and he can just cruise up that line and check that area for anything happening. That just happens to be where my tree stands at. So two different pieces of property that I think back on that I've been successful on from that, and they're both the same situation, catching bucks slipping that low slide of that transition line. And that may be pinch points. That may be just, again, transition lines. And I got an oak ridge that's more open, and they'll be cruising through the oak ridge, but, you know, just down downwind side of that thicket where the does hang out. And so those are a couple of fun spots. But, again, just getting those travel routes that I know that those does have been, or they're going to be at some point cruising in and out of. You can dang sure bet come, you know, November 10th, 7th, 8th, you know, 10th to the 15th, whatever, that he's not going to be far behind. You know, I love seeing 6-7 does go by, and you know, you're thinking, man, why is there not a buck with him? Just give him some time because he's coming. He won't be far behind, and he's going to come and just scent check that area that they just, you know, went into and bedded it, you know. And so, yeah, so I look for those transition lines, bedding areas, you know, on the outside lines of those, and I'll set up shop on that, just knowing that he's going to be on that downwind side. Obviously, you know, you got to work the wind, play the wind on those situations, but looking for those places where I know that buck can cruise that downwind side of it, and he can check that whole area, you know, and they're so slick like that, you know, they'll do that. And I watched the buck come through several years ago on that low side of the bottoms, and I watched and I saw him coming from 100 yards away, and he would come through, and he'd have that nose up and just lip curling. He'd go and make a scrape, he'd check scrapes and licking branches, but he was just working up that, you know, that low bottom side, you know, bottom green briars, all the bedding area, and he was just checking it out. And so just catching those bucks cruising up that line, looking and lifting.
Do you think, because there's really kind of two factions of rut hunting strategies, right? There is that hunt the does strategy. And what you're talking about is playing a doe bedding area. You know, a lot of people will just go to the food sources and wait for the does to come out and hope they bring a buck out with them, which works too. But your strategy is really doable, I think, for more pressured ground stuff. Like I like that. Like personally, I like doe bedding areas and getting on the downwind side way more than playing that food source game for rutting bucks. But then you've got the other faction that's like, I got this badass pinch point. I've got this funnel, whatever it is, that terrain is just like, you're going to go right here. If you go from point A to point B, then you got that strategy. And I kind of think that in my experience, the best hunting I've seen has probably been working those doe bedding areas and playing that downwind game. But in some low density situations or certain situations, you just can't beat that terrain feature. Like if you just have that confidence, like, listen, I got 4 days or 5 days or whatever. If I post up here and the wind doesn't switch out of the north or the west, somebody's coming through. And it's kind of situational, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think about a bottleneck that we've had off a field, beautiful field, but it's kind of the best of both worlds, because you can see in the fields that you've got an incredible bottleneck that's coming up in the timber from a oak ridge, bottleneck coming out of the bottom, and it's money. I mean, it's money. I mean, when the rut comes, you can plan on the does slipping through that bottleneck. It's just a travel route, man. They're going to be somebody coming through there. And there's been a lot of bucks over the years, you know, taken right there. Again, they're not out in the wide open for long, but when they cross, that's the spot they're doing. That bottleneck across that field pinches down to a little gap right there. And I mean, it's just a gauntlet, man. They come through there and a lot of fun in those kind of spots for sure.
Yeah. Those are kind of save your ass situations, because you can sit something like that and just have the confidence that eventually they're coming through. That, you know, playing a doe bedding area type of hunt, it's so situational on the wind. I mean, and I know everything we do is, but some of those you have to be able to get in there, and you have to be mindful of those does. You have to be mindful of playing the wind so it's good for you, or so it's good for him, but better for you. And it's that to me is like a little bit more of a nuanced hunt. I think that's kind of why we lean so hard into the terrain, you know, the funnels pinch point strategy, because some of those are just, they're just no brainers. Like you just see them and you go, well, if they want to get from this ridge to that ridge, they're either going to cross here, or they got to jump 40 feet across this washout, you know, like some of that stuff's just, it's so easy, but there's like a subtlety to that doe bedding area strategy of going, okay, the does are going to come in this way, or they're going to be in here in this spot. He's probably coming from that direction or that direction. He's using the wind to his advantage, and he's using his eyes to his advantage. Now I got to get into a position where he thinks he's safe, but I'm close enough to shoot him. Like that's like a chess game. And that's to me is like the most fun kind of like setup to find when you're in the rut.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you talked about that, just letting that buck feel like he's good. You know, the wind's good for him. But you can make it work as well. And that's so huge, you know, because a lot of guys, I think they say, oh, the wind's bad for me today. Well, man, what is it you got to do to make it doable for you? but still let that buck think, you know, odds are in his favor. And so I do. I like those spots where I've got, you know, a plan A, plan B. So, hey, the wind's not good. Well, I can get right over here and make it good. And just those little subtleties, man, just getting those small little moves. Again, I hunt a lot of crosswind stuff for that reason, just knowing that, hey, this wind may bite me, you know, but I've got just this wind of opportunity. If I can make it, he's going to feel good about it. And I've got my opportunity has tightened up, but it's going to tip the odds for his, you know, his comfort level to be good, but then, you know, for me to be in the right spot as well. And so, again, just sometimes you got to be thinking about those. Is plan B and C, is it still doable, or am I just going to throw it all out when it plan A doesn't work? And so finding those spots where you've got a couple different options to make it happen, even if you're, you know, banging off the ground, if you're just getting in, you know, whatever you got to do, position yourself. Like you said, that's what's so fun about it. It's just that little chess match of just making that move. He thinks he's good, but he has no doubt, no idea that you just shifted 75 yards over around that side of the pinch point, and now you got him, you know. So that's a whole heck of a lot of fun.
It is, and, you know, I think one thing that happens a lot with rut hunts is, you know, we preach this all day sit, and which is a, you know, you should be doing that if you have the right setup. Absolutely. But there's also this reality where you go, I'm going into that river crossing tomorrow, or I'm going into this pinch point, and I'm going to sit all day. I'm bringing my coffee, I'm bringing my sandwiches, and I'm going to find the end of the internet by the end of the day. I'm going to do everything I can to stay there. And then at 11 o'clock, the wind switches, and yeah, you go, well, he could still come from this way or that way. Like, man, you got to know when to pull the plug. And it, like you said, if you have that backup option, pulling the plug is easier. If you don't have that and you talk yourself into sitting there, then you might get in trouble, you know, and it's an in the moment thing. And I think what you really learn when you hunt a lot of different places and you go to a lot of public land where there's just stuff out of your control, you know, like people coming in and what you get kind of used to that mentality. Like, okay, this one went south. What's next? It's not, you know, it's not going to take you out of the game. You're just like, okay, well, a lot of times when I go hunting, shit goes wrong and I got to do something else. And if you expect that and you have that plan B built in place, you know, like there's just times where sometimes you got to get out of that tree and go build a natural ground blind, like you said, you know, or just whatever to stay out there. But to make those decisions and commit to them versus talking yourself into riding out a bad program, it's important. Right. And it's tough. It's tougher than people think.
Yeah. Yeah. So many times guys are like, well, heck, I'm here. I might as well just sit here and ride it out, knowing the wind's rolling up into the completely wrong spot. But it just comes down to laziness and you know, I don't want to move, but I don't want to pull my set down, or I don't want to go back to the truck, whatever. You know, they come up with a million different excuses just to keep doing what they're doing, even though they know it's wrong. And that's so much where we've got to say, you know what, this is wrong. This is no good. It's not going to happen here. And if it does happen here, I'm busted. And you know, you got to just, again, you got to figure out how to roll with the punches, know when to hold them, know when to fold them. And, that's huge, you know, having that, just that mindset where you're willing to do something different. I think that's a lot of it. A lot of guys go, oh, this sucks, man. This is no good. I'm out. But you know, no one say, hey, why is this not good? And how can I make it different? How can I make it better? What do I need to do to improve my odds for success and being willing to do that? You know, just a lot of guys, I mean, you leave a lot of guys behind just by that, you know, having that mentality. Because a lot of them, again, they're just lazy. They want the easy hunt. They want the easy sit. They want the easy action. When it doesn't happen, they're gone. But man, if we can realize, hey, there's a better way, there's another way, it's just going to beef our odds up for sure.
Yeah, I really think that the message of finding a way to stay in the woods longer and not you. So we do this a lot where we make excuses to go out because we kind of like, oh, the wind switched. Well, it's the smart thing to not hunt, or it's 75 degrees on November 6th and it's too, you know, it's the smart thing to not hunt. And I'm always like, just go some, maybe don't go to your best spot, but go. And I know you've seen this. I'll never forget. I mean, I've told this story a million times. The biggest buck I ever killed in my life was on public land in Nebraska in 2014. And that morning, the amount of trucks that came into that property we were hunting was ridiculous. There's about 320 acres of actual like hunting cover in there. And we had like 8 vehicles come in, and there were other guys camped there already. And so, you know, the hunter per square mile there was nuts, right?
Yeah, right.
Guys rattling, whatever. But I went out and that morning, climbed up the ridge, went to the back of the property, killed the biggest buck of my life, saw three other good ones. One of the guys we walked in from Michigan who just happened to be walking in close to us killed a great buck, like a 17-inch wide 8-pointer. And then my buddy killed an 8-pointer on the same ridge. And what was interesting was I shot my buck early. You know, I mean, I had, you know, it happened pretty quickly. And I let him, I thought I smoked him, but I let him lay out a little while. And so then when I found him, you know, it was probably like, I guess, 10, maybe 11 o'clock in the morning when I walked back to camp to go get my deer cart and go back and get this buck. And partially because I didn't want to screw up my buddy because he was down the ridge. But when we got back to camp, those trucks were gone. There was one guy left. And so we watched, you know, 8 trucks come in there in the dark. It was a freaking parade and all these headlamps going out. And on this was like November 7th. By the time I get back at mid-morning, 11 o'clock, they're gone.
Yep.
And those bucks are still out there chasing those does, you know? Yep. And so, and it's really, I think, you know, when I talk to guys like you and I talk to Andy May and Eddie Claypool and these people who are just freaking killers out there, that ability to just kind of go, okay, well, this is what I do now that this didn't work is huge. The ability to adapt and just not only like not make the excuses, just not get down, just go, okay, the circumstances have changed and now I'm going to do this. It really kind of separates the deer watchers from the deer killers a lot of times.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I know you've talked in recent podcasts and over the years about water access and moving water recently. And I love that because that's a lot of my strategy is, you know, you've got some of these guys, like you said, you got headlamps going everywhere. You got trucks at the parking lot, but so many times I'll slip in via the use of a kayak, water access, whatever. And they're banging around up there doing their deal. And I'm going under the radar, slipping in by that kayak down within the banks. And so many times I've just walked in or cruised in on the backside of that stuff and let those guys, all that activity, just push them right down to me. And, like I said, those deer know when they're coming and going, man. They pattern us. They know, hey, 9, 10 o'clock, they're gone, you know, heading back for chicken biscuit. And the woods are wide open again, and they just pick up activity and resume doing their deal. And so I love that water access. Again, slipping on the backside where I know there's a lot of guys doing their thing, slipping again on the backside of that cover. You often look, and you know the deal, the backside of the edge of that water access so many times can be just the ideal bedding cover, ideal cover, hangout, escape route, sanctuary. And so finding myself in those, positioning myself in those, that first part of the rut or whatever, when all those guys coming in off the highway doing their thing and just sitting in that spot, man, it's fun when the sun comes up because, you know, dude, I'm in the right spot. I don't care how many guys come in up off that road. I'm in the right spot for that, you know, exit strategy for those deer. And that can be a lot of fun in and of itself. So yeah, man, don't let the extra traffic. I mean, nobody wants to see that. We're all disappointed when you pull up and there's somebody already there, or there's 5 guys that come after you, or whatever. But man, even with that, like we said, you've got to learn to roll to plan B, C, D, whatever. And even on the front side, just having that idea, that strategy. Hey, this is the public piece. This is probably going to be heavily hit. What's the backside look like? How can I come in by water? How can I hunt the other side of the river that they're not coming to? You know, they're not wearing their waders in or whatever, and I cruise in on those spots, and it opened up a whole new world.
Yeah, and it, you know, that the water access that we've covered that so much, but it is so important. And what it is we really underestimate the impact we make going into spots a lot of times. And you know, you could walk into the best spot out there, and if you walk in wrong, you're not going to have a very good hunt. That's just how it works. If they know you went in there, it's no bueno. And we just do that to ourselves so often. And so not only can you, when you're talking water access or some of these sneaky ways to get in, not only can you get to these parts of properties that maybe aren't getting hunted as hard, you're just getting in a way where they don't know you're there. And you're getting in close to them. And that's one of the things, you know, everybody's hunting mornings now, this time of year. But, you know, I've talked about this so much, and people will say, well, you know, you can't hunt mornings in September and early October. I'm like, that's crazy talk. It's all about your access. About how you can get in and how you plant, where do you park and how do you like circle around? And so much of that is like the work of hunting. Like of just making sure that you're not making a dumb mistake and walking an extra half a mile that's like the real work of hunting pressure deer a lot of times. And it, you know, there are situations where you can't do it. If you got little properties or something like that, they, you just can't do it. But that's part of the reason why we like big chunks of public land sometimes is
that's right.
Like you, yeah, yep. you can go park in the WMA parking area and you can walk the same trail in that everybody takes, or you can park by the bridge there on the highway, drop down there and get into the river and come in the way the deer just don't expect you. And I just think we don't, you know, I always get this kind of revelation every couple of years when I'm hunting up in northern Wisconsin, where the predator population is so freaking high that we have these does and these deer concentrations right by the cabins and right by the houses and right by the highways. And I'm always like, it's so weird that I get back into this swamp and it looks awesome. And it's like a dead sea for deer sign, but I'm hunting this stupid tree row right by this county road. And here's a whole bunch of deer. And I just, maybe there's a different reason, but in my head, I'm like, okay, well, the bears and the coyotes and the wolves and the bobcats, they live in that swamp. And these deer, you know, these does that get smart and they're pulling off a couple fawns or a fawn every year, they're bedding right by the cabin. And they're like, these two-legged predators, I'm not as worried about them because I can pattern them versus those four-leggers that are out here day and night, 24/7, all year round. I think that stuff matters, man.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why we see so many opportunities. If you can legally pull it off hunting closer to houses, hunting closer to roads, and I think about all the deer we drive right by that are sitting there on that, you know, 75 yards off the road, bedded there on a little hump off the side of the road, a little ridge up there, and we drive by them. And I don't want to give away too many secrets that you and I use, but I mean, that's it. I mean, I think about so many of those things, you know, just overlook stuff. So many of the little public pieces that I hunt are not very big at all. You know, they're small pieces of ground, but they're stuff that people drive by every day and they don't think anything of it. And I'm thinking, man, there's deer hanging out in that because there's no pressure there. Yes, it's right there behind the business. Yes, it's right there next to a house or whatever, next to the road. But like you said, those deer have learned there's nothing happening here. There's nothing going on here. There's no pressure here. I'm good to go. And again, they're staying away from that pressure, any predators, whatever it is. And some of those are the best spots for sure.
Yeah. And they can really work in your favor in the rut too. And this is something, this is sort of a message we don't get out much because we talk about the rut solving all of our problems, right? Like all the deer are going to be running like crazy and they're going to be going through these pinch points and this fence crossing and whatever. But when you go out, even when you hunt a good place, like there's no guarantee of that. Like there, you know, you can have I think the hardest thing about the rut a lot of times is our expectations are so high. And then you get out there and you realize like, I could go sit all day and not see a deer or see one deer. And then it's like, how do you stay in the game there? And when you think about, you know, like what you're talking about here with these concentrations of deer, wherever they're going to be, if they're right next to the county road or whatever, like you have to find that now. Like you have to be open to looking for that. Just like you said, with your staging area strategy earlier, if you go try that thing you believe in your heart and soul where the deer are coming, they don't come. Okay.
Yeah.
Where are they? You know?
Yeah.
And this comes up a lot, but you see this, especially this time of year where deer are laying down sign, man. Like they're letting you know. And if you go and you're like, I'm gonna hike all the way back to the back of this property, I'm gonna be snorting lines of freaking mountain ops off the back of my pack to make it back there, whatever. And then you get back there and it's just not happening. But you walk through an area of 200 yards from the parking lot that had a bunch of sign in it, you missed it. Yeah. And everybody does this. Like we fall in love with our ideas and we fall in love with our strategies. And then you get out into nature and nature says, actually it's happening right here, bro. Walk by it. Don't walk by it. I don't care. But what you actually want to find is all around you right now. And you're married to this idea that you got to go here or do this or sit this spot. And it's just not, it's not so cut and dry.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to that. Then you got so much of the idea. Unfortunately, so many of the YouTube channels and public strategies and all the stuff that we're seeing in social media and YouTube, you see so many guys that are pushing the whole deal of, I mean, you got to walk 6 miles in here. And then the next guy's like, oh dude, no, I walked 7 miles. And it's this contest of who's the baddest dude in the woods public hunting. And you can't hunt under 2 miles from the truck and be a man. You know what I'm saying? That's what the chicks do, right? The girls that are just getting started, that's what they do. anybody that's been hunting long, any man's going to walk at least 3 or 4, maybe 5 miles. And you know, I've got nothing to prove anymore, man. I'm not into that. If I find deer within 100 yards of the road and I can legally hunt, you know, a couple hundred yards from the road, whatever. I'm right next to the road. I mean, go with a sign. Don't leave deer to go find deer. You know, that's the biggest thing. And we do that so many times just to prove something that we're tougher. We walked into the woods and, you know, beat the mosquitoes and, you know, whatever. I think we're in a dangerous spot right now because everybody wants to be the baddest deer hunter in the woods. You know what I'm saying? You see it all the time, you know, and it's if you're not hunting public land or if you're not hunting out of saddle, if you're not, you know, hunting 50 feet in a tree, you know, whatever, it just keeps going up and up. And what do you got to do to be the baddest dude, you know, in the woods or whatever? It's like, man, make it, you know, just kill deer, you know. I mean, you don't have to get all this stuff on to impress everybody else. Just do what it takes to kill deer and don't worry about all the other stuff.
Yeah. And go have some freaking fun. And all right, we can't help ourselves. I was talking to a buddy of mine this morning who he killed a freaking stud buck in Minnesota last year. I don't remember what it scored. It was like upper 140s, I think. But it was heavy, and it was a freaking toad of a deer. It was a great buck. And he said he talked to a guy the other day who saw a picture of it, and the guy was like, yeah, you know, this area of the state would be good if you guys would just stop shooting all those little 3-year-olds. And this deer was a toad. Nobody's passing up this deer. Like, right. Unless your name, if your last name's Lukoski or Drury, you might pass. Otherwise, nobody else is. Like, right. Everybody kills this buck. And he was just like, I'm just so sick of that kind of idea that, like, you know, like, you're so special if you target huge bucks, or like, maybe not even that, just to like talk down on other people's deer. It's just, it's so bizarre. And we just can't help ourselves. Like, we're so locked into the trophy thing that we just forget, like, man, this is supposed to be fun. Like, when you go climb into that tree, you're supposed to be enjoying it. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that I really like talking to the hunting public guys. Like, I think that, you know, everybody's like, oh, Zach showed us how to stalk deer on the ground, or they showed us that deer can be killed in public land. Like, they did that. But what they did was they showed people that you can have a hell of a lot of fun doing this stuff. And like, I think that was like sort of the great intangible that made them so popular, is people looked at that and they go, these guys are having fun. Like, they're not taking themselves super seriously and, you know, preaching this bullshit of, you know, the trophy management stuff. They're just like, we're just out here enjoying it our way and having a blast. And like, that's refreshing. And I think, I think that's what we have to be like really careful with when we talk about rut hunting. Like I kind of mentioned earlier, is people are so often like, this is my chance to go kill a giant. Like, yeah, you know, 20% of bow hunters might do that. Or, you know, by this time of the season, maybe 10 or 12% of bow hunters will fill their tags in November and be done. The rest of you won't. Like, okay. So do you want to, like, and if you want to hold out, go ahead, but do you want to go have a lot of fun? Like, that might not be it for you. Like, waiting for that 170 just because it's the rut might not work. You know, like, you go out and start working these deer concentrations like we're talking about, instead of saying like, it's November 7th, I'm only targeting big bucks. Like, you can be hunting for that, but if you're not hunting for deer concentrations where they are right now, you're probably missing the boat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So true. And like you said, man, just positioning yourself where it can happen, getting your odds up, but just not missing out on the fun. My gosh, man. Like you said, the percentage of guys that are going to kill that stud, giant, what you dream about, the buck we all dream about, those are pretty few and far between, depending on where you are in the country. For me, it's more like, man, you know what? It's the first week of November. Anything can happen with every time I sit in that stand. I'm not going to miss out. Just the excitement of knowing that anything can happen every time I put my butt in that stand. That to me is where it's at. Just the fun of that. Just knowing that, man, I'm not missing a sunrise because, again, it's the first week, second week of November, end of October, whatever. And dude, anything can happen. I mean, it's just at this time of year. And so I want to ride it out and be there as much as I can. And, you know, hunt smart. You know, obviously don't just go blowing up your spots just because you feel like you need to be there every day. But hunt smart, strategically. But just be there. It's time to be there, man. And get in the woods and, again, catch those bucks as they first start to venture out from those beds. And get wandering a little further and a little further, and he's realizing, and your trail cameras will show you, you know, if you run trail cameras, you're going to see, hey, he's, you know, he's gone from coming out into the field or whatever at 12 o'clock at night. Now he's, you know, 10 o'clock, and now it's creeping, you know, and you'll see that little trend, that transition. He starts creeping closer and closer, and it's happened at this time of year. Next thing you know, he's right there right before dark, and those are times where I say, you know what, I've got to be there, because he's creeping closer and closer to daylight, and then boom, next thing you know, here he comes down the trail. So it's, you got to be there this time of year. Absolutely.
That's, you bring up a good point there about trail cameras, where, you know, the midnight picture, yeah, that's cool, whatever, he's there, but that picture right after dark on that food plot or that field edge, that's telling you something. Like, that's, right. that's telling you, you're not dealing with a nocturnal deer. You're dealing with a deer you can kill in a staging area. The other thing you said there about, you know, not missing a sunrise. I think when you get to a certain age and you get a lot of experience in this, you realize, you know, like maybe the first 2 weeks of November are the best example out in the outdoors. Like when you've done this a lot, you want to put yourself in the woods, like, because how many Novembers are you going to get? It's like elk hunting. Like, you go elk hunting and you have one good elk hunt, it's like, how many, you know, if you live where a lot of the listeners here do, you're not getting that many weeks in the mountains before you're dead, or, you know, the first 4 or 5 days of turkey season. Like, you want to miss that one of those more, no way, man. The thing about it is the fun of deer hunting. We've painted this picture of, like, and we default to this all the time. I do it all the time, where it's the killing the big bucks is kind of what we default to talking about. But one of the things that makes it so damn enjoyable is believing you got a real shot of seeing deer. Like, when you go, like, you talked about that bottleneck stand, that's just money. When the conditions set up and you've got some history with a spot, or you walk in and the freaking sign is legit, and you hang that stand or you saddle up, and you just believe it, even when you don't see anything. Like, if you flame out for whatever reason, that's still more fun than a lot of hunts, because you're sitting there going, any second. It's, you know, that's one of the reasons that those early season, you know, velvet hunts, or those early season Western kind of river type hunts are so fun. You know, you sit up there in glass and you go, Jesus, I saw 17 deer cross here yesterday, and I'm going to go hang a stand here today. Like, even if for whatever reason, a pack of coyotes, a mountain lion comes in, other hunters, and it gets blown up, the time that you're sitting there, you're like, this is there. I can't think of hardly a better way to use my time than plant my butt in a tree then.
Yeah, absolutely. And that happened back in early season, you know, in Kentucky. I remember sitting there knowing I'm in the right spot. It's going to happen. Just that nausea, just that, almost the butterflies, my hands start sweating that last 30, 45 minutes of daylight. I'm sitting there and my hands are sweating. I hadn't even seen a deer yet, but just knowing, hey, it's about to happen. It's about to go down. And again, I get the butterflies, I get the jitters, nausea, sweaty hands. And like, Lord have mercy, I don't know if I can handle this when it does happen, you know? And gosh, that, just again, that experience, that excitement, that's why we need to do it, man. You're going to have, if you can learn to love that, that's, you're going to get more of that than you are that encounter with a giant. That's few and far between, like we said, but man, if you can learn to love the experience, love just the journey along the way to get into that shot opportunity, man, that's where you're going to make your money, man. That's the good stuff. That's just enjoying it. And in my mind, being there for the right reason, just enjoying the journey along the way and not missing out on all that, because you're so focused on, I've got to find this one buck that I saw one time on a trail camera at midnight back in August. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, so many people will just blow their whole season for something that a fleeting glance of a deer they've never seen in daylight. And so, man, just enjoy the ride, enjoy the journey. There's nothing like it.
Yeah. And I want to tie a bow on this with it, to go back to that, what you said about, you know, not missing a sunrise. Like, that's one thing that I'm trying to, like, really instill in my daughters. Like, I do this in the summer with our smallmouth fishing, you know, because they can get up, we can get up and we can hit the lake at sunrise. There's no boats out. There's no jet skiers. There's no other kids to play with yet. Everybody's still sleeping. You just get that moment of, you know, 2 hours of awesome topwater fishing, and it doesn't take away anything else from your day, really. I mean, you might be a little tired, but it's like, you never regret it. Even when you go out and the fishing's not that good, you got a cold front come in or something happens, you still never regret it. Just like getting up for turkey. It's just like getting out there, you know, even if it's November 20th and you're like, oh man, it's going to be a lockdown and you know, whatever's not happening. I'm like, man, maybe, you know, maybe it's going to suck, but if you go into it and still think, oh, it's November and something could happen, and like, there's a lot worse ways to spend your time. Like, go get into the woods. Like, I think that one of the biggest keys to becoming like a really content, you know, happy hunter who kills a lot is just accepting the fact that you like being out there more than anything else. And just making that whenever, if the family's squared away and everything's squared away and you can be out there, be out there.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. You got to put your time in. I remember reading articles, you know, about that kind of stuff when I was a kid, you know, magazine articles of you just got to put your time in. You got to put your time in, hunt as much as you can. And like you said, I mean, you got to take care of your responsibilities and your family and make sure you're not neglecting time you need to be having with your wife and kids. But my gosh, man, you got to put that time in. I mean, I know so many days where I've slept in and just got lazy, you know, I've been beating it up all through archery season. And, you know, again, November gets here and I'm like, gosh, dang, I don't, you know, you start making excuses for why you're going to not hunt this stand or whatever. And I'm like, dude, you can sleep. You can sleep in December or January. You know, when you can sleep during duck season, whatever, after duck season. But you've got to get there, man. And like you said, you can take that midday nap, whatever. But man, I just hate to miss a morning. Just out of, you know, being lazy during the rut. You know, these first few weeks of November. Gosh, you just as much as I can be, I'm going to try to be out there. And you know, again, hunting smart, but just not missing out on those opportunities when they come by. So,
yeah, I really realized how important that was when I quit drinking, and I woke up every day like, okay, you know, I'm still tired and stuff like, but just not feeling like shit, and just like, it just how it changed my perspective of every hunt and every string of hunts, where it's, you know, you're on a trip with your buddies and it's 7 days, or it's the sixth day of your rutcation. Just, it made me appreciate being out there a hell of a lot more, because I wasn't fighting against this, anything that I was dragging myself down with, man. It changed everything. It's so worth being out there. Everybody's listening to this. Do not take any time off during the rut. Even if you hunt the same public land that I do, or Brody does, go out there with us. Brody, as always, man, it's so much fun to talk to you. Thanks for coming on. Good luck. Good luck with your rattling in the next week, and good luck with all of your rut hunts this year, buddy.
Hey man, same to you. I look forward to seeing some pictures roll through. Shoot me some messages. Let me know what's happening these next few weeks.
Awesome. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, man.
That's it for this week, folks. Be sure to tune in next week for more whitetail goodness. This has been Wired to Hunt, and I'm your guest host, Tony Peterson. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if you're looking for more whitetail content, and we know you are this time of year, be sure to check out themeateater.com/wired to see a pile of new articles each week by Mark, myself, and a whole slew of whitetail addicts, or head over to the Wired to Hunt YouTube channel to view the weekly content we are dropping there.